there's been plenty of times where I'm like, wow, I can't imagine wanting that. But that's so great that that person consented to that and wants that and is like getting exactly what they wanted. Good for them. You know, like I can just be compersive towards them. I'm happy for them. I don't need to have that. I don't want to have that, but they're happy. And so that's, so, you know, some of it's fascinating in that way. And then you walk around and you see people doing things that you're like, oh, ooh, ooh, that could be really fun. Ooh, I do want some of that, you know? So it, I think it helps people, being in environments like that can really help people figure out sexually what is erotic for them.
Hello and welcome to Here in LA, Highland Park Edition. Today we talk with Imagine. Imagine and I have known each other for decades, literally. She's a writer, an educator, a best-selling author, a sexpert, and an inspirational speaker. She does it all. She grew up in Southern California, went to school in Santa Barbara, which is where we met, has lived in a few spots in LA, and around COVID, oh my God, she left us. Well, this podcast is about all of LA. Those who've just moved here, those who've been here forever, those who have been here for half of their lives, those who are here now, and a few who have sought greener pastures elsewhere. Imagine fits into the latter category, and we will talk about sex, drugs, rock and roll, and Highland Park. So get ready to rock. Hey, everybody. I'm in Highland Park with Imagine.
Hey.
Imagine, do you have a last name?
Not these days. I decided I get to have a mononym. Like Madonna did it, Prince did it, Beyonce is still doing it. I figure I can do it. I've never met another Imagine.
How did you come across this name? How did you did you discover it? Did you make it?
Gifted to me by spirit. It was the only way it could happen. I couldn't think my way to that name. I waited for the name for like 20 years.
Really?
Yeah. I knew in my 30s I was going to change my name. Uh-huh. One day when I figured out to what.
You're not 50.
Yeah, baby.
Are you?
I'm in my 50s.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is a beautiful woman with like short platinum-ish hair, an amazing Frida Kahlo shirt, tattoos, rainbow sneakers, brand new Vans that are leopard skin. I mean, we should own our ages, but you really look about 35.
We're only as old as we think.
Beautiful blue eyes.
They're green, but thank you.
What?
They're so green. And I'm even wearing a green shirt. Come on.
They're bluer than that shirt, that's for sure.
Oh.
Okay, so we have known each other since, how old were you when we first met?
19.
That's 19. Crazy.
I've known you well over 30 years now.
That is nuts.
Yeah.
And did we meet at KCSB or at the Nexus? We went to college together.
We probably met in the courtyard at Stork Tower,
the
communications tower, where all the writers from the paper and all the music heads from the radio station would hang out.
We went to college together at UC Santa Barbara, late 80s, early 90s. Perfect time. Greatest time ever. And have remained friends forever, which is great.
He's still one of my best buddies.
Yay. So you are no longer in Highland Park. You moved away from Highland Park.
I did.
And this podcast is not a PR thing for LA. It's real about LA.
Nobody loves LA that I know more than you.
Oh.
You love Los Angeles.
I do.
And you know Los Angeles. You know it in a way that's very different from most
people.
I'm
learning it. This is one of the things that Uber has humbled me as far as that goes. When I started driving Uber, I realized I didn't know shit about LA. And I mean, I've worked for all the, any publication that has LA in it, I've probably worked for it.
Right.
And 10, 15 years ago, I realized I really don't know it because I ended up in neighborhoods. For example, this backyard. Who would have known about this backyard? Where your old apartment was, or your old house was in Highland Park.
Mm-hmm.
I'd never been to those blocks.
Yeah.
So when people would say Highland Park, I would think about Figueroa.
Right.
I would think about York. But I guess I just never really knew about where people lived.
I was in the little like valley of Highland Park. I was in the lowland of
the lowlands close to the 110.
Close to the 110 and the river. Yeah. Between 110 and the river.
So what was it like living there?
I really liked Highland Park. You know, it was sometimes walkable, not as walkable as I would love. Not like when I lived in Brooklyn, but yeah, I,
would you walk to, Figueroa and get a burrito?
Oh, I would walk to my favorite taco truck. They open at 5 every day right there on, right off of Figueroa and York.
Mm-hmm.
Oh yeah. I walked over there.
So you did walk a bunch.
I did. I walk sometimes. Yeah. But it would like be a little far to walk all the way down to Donut Friend or something.
Yeah.
I mean.
So you would drive there?
Usually.
Were you the only white person on your block?
No, not at all.
There was a bunch of white people.
Oh, yeah. It was a mix. It was a mix of folks.
You were renting this house. How many bedrooms in this house?
It was a little 2-bedroom, 1-bath.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And what years did you live there?
2018 to 2020 or 2017, maybe, to 2020. Yeah.
It's about 3 years.
Yeah.
How much were you paying?
How much was I paying? $2,200 a month, maybe?
That seems like a steal today, doesn't it?
I don't know. I live in New Mexico now. I pay like almost half that now.
Oh, do you really?
I do.
Where in
New
Mexico?
For a 3-bedroom, 2-bath, large house in the mountains.
So you're not in a city?
What's that?
You're not in a city?
No.
You're in the country?
I'm in the country.
In the mountains, paying $1,000, did you say?
I'm paying like $1,400 for a 3-bedroom house.
3-bedroom.
Yeah.
That's the dream, right?
I mean, it was pandemic, and I was like, what am I doing here? I can't see any of my friends. They're telling us we can't even go to the beach.
This is when you were in Highland Park.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, in 2020.
They did say we couldn't go to the beach.
It was ridiculous. I'm like, you're going to tell Los Angelenos they can't go to the fucking beach? Can I say fucking on your podcast?
I wish you would.
I mean, nobody cared. We all did it anyway. But right. They were trying to prevent us from being at the beach for a little while. But yeah, you know, my friends were pretty intense about COVID things. And I couldn't see anybody. So I was like, I'm going to go live next door to my best friend. I called up my BFF in New Mexico. I was like, hey, I'm going to travel for a little bit. I'm going to start with you guys. You know, I was at like both of our kids' births and, you know, they're like teenagers now. One of them's 20. Oh, my God. Yeah. So I called her up. I said, I'm going to come to you guys first. And she's like, oh, our renters next door just gave notice after 8 years to move out. You can move in next door to me. So I literally got to move to New Mexico to this beautiful spot in the mountains, live next door to my best friend, and get all the hugs I wanted. And got to see, you know, my nibbling finish high school and go through a gender transition and the whole thing. And then one turned into a full-on teenager right before our eyes.
The kid that you saw come to this world... Had a transition?
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, so it was so cool to be there for that.
Did drag queens cause this transition?
Yeah, it was definitely the drag queens. We should blame them. They do so many good works in the world. This is just one of them.
We should note that Imagine is a sexpert. Is that how you describe yourself? That's how I describe you to people.
Sure, that works. Sex educator.
Sex educator.
Author. Writer.
That's right.
Speaker. All the things. Filmmaker.
That's true. We'll talk about your film in a second.
Yeah.
Your most popular book is called?
Lesbian Sex Secrets for Men. Bestseller. You know, sells itself. Doesn't need me.
Perfect title.
Or it did it one time. My last book was Woman on Fire. 9 elements to wake up your erotic energy, personal power, and sexual intelligence. How's your erotic energy doing today, Tone?
Meh. Erotic. 56 years old, you should see my belly.
Your belly could be really erotic.
That turns all the ladies on.
It might. It might. Okay. Some people might love that.
That's true. That is
Some
true.
Some people might love a soft, hairy belly to lay their little head on.
There is a screw for every bolt.
There really is.
Or something like that.
It's true.
There's a nut for every bolt. What
a
are those?
A bolt for every screw.
But there is, though, isn't there?
Yeah.
And people should think about that.
Yeah.
That whatever you think you see in the mirror, somebody else is going to be sexually turned on by what you see?
Yeah, sure. And like, I mean, it's just like the, like whatever crazy porn scenario you can come up with, someone's made it already. Like,
well,
look it up on the internet. You'll find it.
Okay, but that's porn. In real life, though.
I know. I'm just talking about the fantasy world.
In real life, does a cheerleader really want to deliver a pizza to me?
I don't know. Maybe. People are just, you know, have obvious fears around safety and prevents us from getting to play some of those things out. But if you have fun friends who like to play, then you can create all kinds of scenarios with your friends.
And so this is... Okay, you've invited me to some of these things before, and I respectfully declined because I'm just not that person. I want to be that person,
right?
But I'm, and I don't know.
And I think it's good to know that. It's good to know that about yourself.
I guess maybe I have an insecurity that of the group of people, they don't want me. So your friends over here, these very handsome men.
Yep.
I think they want them. They definitely want you.
You'd be surprised, Tone. You'd be surprised.
Okay. When was your first, do you call them orgies? When was your first group event? About how old were you for your first group situation? Do you remember?
Good question. Well, I mean, I had threesomes in college.
You did?
Yes.
I didn't know.
Yes, I was coming into my queerness and had a boyfriend. I had to do something.
Who was your boyfriend?
Vincent.
Oh, Vincent. Vincent got you and another girl over
yeah.
there?
Yeah,
that lucky son of a...
I know.
The other black guy at UCSB.
I was friends with all four of you. There was you,
there
Vincent,
was
Sean, and Monty.
You... Monty! MCPs. Please don't tell me MCPs got some of this. This threesome business?
No.
All right, good. I was jealous enough of him. His
he was my
taste.
Coworker. We kept it on the sort of professional.
So in Isla Vista, there was threesomes happening. No big deal.
Yes, definitely.
God.
I'm sure there's much more than that happening now.
Do you think so?
Yes.
I feel like the kids are a lot tamer these days.
Some of them are, but they're, you know, yeah.
Okay. So over time, okay, so what...
They've grown up with the internet. We didn't grow up with the internet. Imagine what we would have been doing if we had grown up with the internet. I do a little bit. I'm getting on the TikTok these days a little bit.
There are some very forward young ladies nowadays.
Yeah.
And they have this daddy kink where they want older guys. Should I believe them?
No heterosexual woman wants to date, when she's young, wants to date boys her age.
Why?
Because they're so immature and stupid.
Do we get any better when we get older?
Some of them do.
Okay.
Some of you do.
I'm still wearing a baseball cap.
You are.
I am still just as immature. I have Drew Barrymore poster on my wall. I don't think I'm the daddy that they want.
Maybe not. I don't know.
Okay. So what was the biggest group event that you had? Number of people? Approximately.
That I've been to?
Yeah, like how big was the biggest orgy you were ever at?
Well, I've been to adult sex camps. So when you go to sex camp, it's at like a, you know, at least the ones I went to. I used to teach at them a lot. You know, it takes place at a summer camp. So there's cabins of people that come together. There's tents. You know, you walk through the grounds and someone's over there getting flogged against a tree, and then you go by the dungeon and there's people playing in the dungeon, and then you walk down to the woods and there's someone getting, you know, a blowjob or whatever, like doing some scene in the woods. You go down by the water, somebody's doing something at the water. I mean, it's just, there's workshops happening and all these workshop spaces, you know, and then at night there's like special parties and themes and sexy times.
So this
it's
like
just it's an adult playland.
Of 100 people, of 200 people?
Oh, that was easily 700-800.
700 or 800?
Yeah, I would say so.
800 people in the woods. The woods are that big that you guys have give privacy?
It might not have been that much. Maybe it was 500. I don't know.
People.
But it was a good amount of people.
That's a lot of people.
Yeah, it's kind of like an experiment of like what would happen if we bring the queer kinksters together with the tantra people and the, you know, just overall sex pause folks, Yeah, it's sort of like a mix of various sort of outlier, you know, and then the swingers would be there. You know, it's like different sort of like sexual outlier communities who like group play.
Is this just heaven for a sexpert?
I mean, it's fun for me. I mean, it's all research, Tone.
For example, if I was somebody who just loved to eat a lot of food, I would love to go to like a Vegas buffet. Is it kind of like a Vegas buffet for a foodie?
Sure. You look at the buffet and you're like, I don't want any of that. That does not look good to me. But I'm glad somebody likes that. Okay, fine. You know, mm-hmm. Ooh, what is that? I've never seen that before. That's fascinating. I'll try a little of that. You know, oh, here's my favorite. Oh, yeah. Pile that one on. Lots of that. Sure.
And because I imagine because of the situation, nobody's being judgmental. Nobody's being... Are sometimes people being too aggressive?
There's a lot of rules in in any good community, and any good sex party is going to have, they're going to set the container so it can hold people and lead people into what could be a fun, playful, consensual space for lots of different people. Mm-hmm. So there's always rules, and there's, you know, in any good play space, there's going to be some kind of like opening circle or opening icebreakers, you know, way to meet each other and find out what each other's into. People will do a little go around like, here's what I'm interested in tonight.
Oh.
These are the things that are off the table for me.
Mm-hmm.
This is my STI status and the last time I was tested.
Good.
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah.
And so do you wear like a hat? Do you have wristbands? Like, how do I know, like, on day two, oh, yeah, that's the person who doesn't like that?
You talk to people and you find out what they're into. I know. It's a crazy idea.
Communication and sex? Wait a second here.
I know. It makes it so much hotter if people would just get that.
This sounds like it's just a wonderful place.
It's pretty fun. It's pretty fun. And I think it's also, you know, there's been plenty of times where I'm like, wow, I can't imagine wanting that. But that's so great that that person consented to that and wants that and is like getting exactly what they wanted. Good for them. You know, like I can just be compersive towards them. I'm happy for them. I don't need to have that. I don't want to have that, but they're happy. And so that's, so, you know, some of it's fascinating in that way. And then you walk around and you see people doing things that you're like, oh, that could be really fun. Ooh, I do want some of that, you know? So I think it helps people, being in environments like that can really help people figure out sexually what is erotic for them. Because sometimes we just don't know. Like earlier you were talking about someone you know that mm-hmm. doesn't fantasize. They don't. A woman who like doesn't really have any fantasies, doesn't have a lot of sexual feelings. Like there's a lot of people like that. Mm-hmm. I've been working primarily with women and non-binary folks on sexuality for a long time. And I mean, I think a lot of it is that oftentimes people are not as visually motivated in the same way. And I think, you know, we have seen some differences in the research based around looking at people's sex characteristics. Mm-hmm. I always hate to make those kinds of generalizations, but there is some of that. And I think for a lot of heterosexual women in particular, I think they haven't seen the thing that would really turn them on. So they don't even think about it because they don't know about it.
Mm.
I think we're in a different time where there's a lot more out there. There's a lot more ways to see it and to find it if they want to seek it out. But they may not necessarily think to do that in the same way.
Talking about how some women don't even know what will be exciting to them, but women read romance novels and talk to each other more than men do.
Yeah.
Do women not talk about what pleases them to each other?
I mean, I'm sure different friend groups approach that differently. Some people are just not comfortable admitting what they really like.
Even to their besties.
Listen, the two greatest sexual fears people have are the fear of being rejected and the fear of being judged. So,
right. Right.
That fear of being judged prevents people from being honest about sexuality in all kinds of ways. Mm-hmm. With all kinds of people, depending what level that fear is at.
So you used to do these incredibly popular Fire Woman retreats.
I did.
In San Diego?
In North County, yeah. Okay. At the Fire Garden in Encinitas.
And at this place, and the reason I know about this is a girl I dated went a couple times.
Yeah.
Loved
it. She went like every time, I think.
Totally loved it.
Yeah.
And I would imagine, she told me a little bit about it without revealing confidentiality. Mm-hmm. I mean, she couldn't stop talking because she was so energized by it.
Yep.
And in fact, called you the Oprah of sex.
best title anyone ever gave.
And by the way, remember I drove some other women to the site.
Yeah.
Who had flown in from like Ohio or Oregon or somewhere.
Yeah.
They too agreed with her.
Yeah.
That you're the Oprah of sex.
Yeah. That's sweet. I love that.
So I guess one reason that women responded so positively to that retreat was, to your point, that it seems like women have a hard time sometimes expressing themselves for what they want for a number of reasons, including the fact that we call women nasty names when they're in touch with their sexuality and
totally.
They ask for what they want.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think it's very hard. I think it's very hard for anyone to just really be who they are sexually in this world. Like, honestly. So people who do that are courageous. Like, we need more examples of that. And, you know, at Fire Woman, part of it, there were so many pieces, you know, but I really always saw the biggest part of my job wasn't as much education as giving people permission. And just because they need that permission from somewhere, and that's, you know, that permission can hopefully carry them until they get to the point where they just give it to themselves. You know, but having someone saying, hey, it's okay to explore this. Yeah, go over to the spanking booth and try a spanking. See if you like that. Go over and hold a flogger and see what it feels like to, like, swing a flogger. You know, go and learn how to, you know, write erotic poetry with this person over here. You know, whatever it was, like, it gave people, we did an erotic carnival where we would have, like, maybe 10, 12 stations. And people could just go try on a different skill. They could try, you know, oh, let me try this over here, this over there. And so it was a big production. I brought in a lot of teachers, people who knew how to tie rope, people who showed people how to do electricity play, people who...
Electricity?
Sure.
So like those wands that shock you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Have you had that before?
Yeah.
Do you like that?
I think I like giving it more than I like receiving
Ooh.
It. Yeah, I'm more of a top with electricity.
Interesting.
Some people love it, though.
It seemed to me that at some point in your weekend, your Fire Woman weekend, the ladies are just naked, just walking around.
Sometimes, yeah.
In the hot tub,
no.
Whatever it is. In the car on the way home, they're naked. You really do free them of the stuff, and now they feel free.
Yeah, and I think there's something that happens when people are able to work on their own liberation and community. You know, when you have witnesses to your desires and permission for the things that you really want instead of all the things you've been told your whole life that you're supposed to want, which we all get, but I think women really get, you know. And I work with moms all the time who it's like, well, you know, be sexy, but don't be too sexy because you're a mom. And, you know, it's like there's this like middle zone everyone is supposed to inhabit where they're, you know, not frumpy, but they're also not whatever is considered over the top sexy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we get to own it wherever it is. Mm-hmm. But I think when you're in community and you get that kind of permission, encouragement, witnessing, camaraderie, You know, and then also then you see people taking, making courageous moves, then you're more likely to make your own courageous move. Whatever that is, whether that's being naked in front of other women is a really, you know, wild, you know, unusual, risky thing for me, or admitting to a fantasy that I have, or, you know, coming out, or deciding I want to explore some part of my sexuality, whatever that is, mm-hmm. whatever that is.
What's the first step that people should do to feel better about themselves?
I mean, I think a big piece of it is creating a bit of an analysis of what you've taken in, what you've been told is appropriate for you as a sexual being, and then doing whatever it takes for you to get to that place of feeling like you have permission to like and be turned on by whatever mm-hmm. is really true. And so I think for some people, that means unlearning a lot of the conditioning they might have grown up with, particularly if they grew up in religious communities or communities where there was a lot of intense repression around sexuality. Mm-hmm. For some people, that may be just, you know, there's always going to be a phase or many phases of education and exposing themselves to new ideas and exploring things. And, you know, and unfortunately, there aren't a lot of places to do that. And that's part of what made Fire Women so special. It was this space where people could truly explore who they were as sexual people.
Let's turn the page to your film. Your film is called At Your Cervix?
At Your Cervix. The film is about gynecology through the lens of gynecological education. We're looking at medical education in the film. And, like, I mean, how many people actually think about, well, where does a gynecologist first learn to do a pelvic exam? Do I want to be the first one? Probably not.
Right. Right.
I think there's very many regular folks who are trying to be somebody's first exam. They have to learn in some way, and many of them do learn with trained teachers who use their own bodies to teach, go into medical schools and teach in clinical settings. That is work that I did for 10 years in New York. I was really committed to helping the medical community with sexuality. And when I learned about gynecological teaching associate work, I wanted to do that. I'm someone that's really comfortable with my body. I'm comfortable teaching using my body. I think the body is an amazing teaching tool. Why wouldn't we use that to teach a good pelvic exam? So that work has a long history. It started in the 70s. We wanted to chronicle that work in the film, but then as we started working on the film, we realized many, many students are being told to, you know, quote unquote, air quotes here, practice pelvic exams on anesthetized patients.
Oh, so hold on. Let's rewind just a bit. You would put yourself in the stirrups.
Right.
And let these medical students do an examination on you, and you would provide feedback to them
exactly.
while they're doing it.
Exactly.
Because the traditional way was to give somebody laughing gas or whatever, make them pass out, and perform the exam on a passed out person?
They've perhaps done that in the past. I mean, lots of unsavory things have happened in medicine. But no, this is very much a thing of the present.
Still they do this?
Oh, yeah. Research came out last year showing that 84% of medical students have done exams on non-consenting, most of the time, anesthetized patients who've come in for a surgery.
Like a broken knee? What kind of surgery?
It took us years. Part of why it took so long to make the film is we were looking for patient stories. And most people don't know this has happened to them because they were anesthetized.
Right.
So there are sometimes ways people find out. And it took us quite a few years to find the three stories that we did find for the film. One of those stories was about an exploratory knee surgery.
It was a knee story.
Yeah. and someone had an exam, at least one, they don't probably necessarily know how many, while they were under anesthesia. There was gauze with iodine on it, on their vulva after their surgery. They asked the facility. They had heard about this. They knew that it happened. And so they then called the facility and said, did this happen to me? Is that what's happened? And the facility confirmed it and said, yes.
Is that legal to do?
In a lot of states, it is. We are actually, this is part of what we're working on with At Your Cervix, is we're trying to end this practice. This practice is assault. And in any other context, if someone is inebriated or under the influence of something where they cannot properly consent and you insert something into their vagina, it is very clear what that is.
Because Lord knows, if this happened to men, if we went in for a shin surgery and our booty holes were explored for practice and we didn't consent to it, we'd burn down that hospital.
That actually does happen.
But it happens the thing, to men?
Yes. But there's not as much research on it, so we don't have as many numbers, but definitely I know that that happens. I've heard people talk about that.
And what do the medical professionals say as their excuse?
They know they're in a teaching hospital, so they should just know.
Oh, so this only happens in teaching hospitals?
No, it can happen in a lot of different kinds of facilities where there are students. It's very common for it to happen when medical students are there. This, and I think it's important to say, this isn't even a good way to learn a pelvic exam.
Because the person's passed out.
They're passed out. No real pelvic exam is ever going to feel like that. Their muscles are never going to be that relaxed.
Right.
They're not going to even feel like that. And so it's not a good learning scenario. The only real opportunity for learning there, which is a real opportunity, is to be able to palpate some kind of pathology. If there's a pathology present, fibroids or cysts or whatever, mm-hmm. tumors, things. But again, there's no reason to not just ask and get permission.
Right. And so like one of the things I'm sure that when you are the volunteer, the volunteer subject.
We're paid.
Who's also the, well, what I'm saying is you're the patient kind of.
Yes. Teacher patient.
You could say things like, hey man, your hands are cold, or
exactly,
the equipment is cold.
Exactly.
You
got to
warm it up. Mm-hmm. A passed out person can't say that.
Yeah. Or we'll say, that's feeling really pokey. That doesn't feel good. Could you shift your wrist down a little bit? And that would make that more comfortable. But we know how to direct them. We're trained really well. We know how to direct them to make it a comfortable exam. And those students walk out of there glowing. I mean, they've never had that kind of instruction before, and they probably will never get it again unless they get GTAs again in their medical careers.
And I've got to say, you are also, I imagine, you are humanizing the patient.
Exactly.
Because rarely
exactly
is that patient giving real instructional feedback to the doctor, I bet.
Right. But what we are doing that turns medical education on its head is we're saying to them, by the way that we teach, when you come into a room with a patient, you're not looking to the side to your colleague to get to that authority over the body to get information about this patient's body who's right in front of you. You ask the patient. They are the authority over their own body. And I think that piece is the great, that whole way that we hold the work where, and GTA programs across the country and in other parts of the world can definitely vary. We are very much against having someone from the medical faculty in the room. They do not get to come in the room and be the authority. It is very important that patient that's on the table be the teacher. So we're training them that's the person you ask.
Mm-hmm. I love it. Okay. So this movie has taken a long time to get made. Mm-hmm. It looks like you're making, I mean, you've been making progress over the last while, but it looks like you're kind of in the home stretch. Has it all been edited together?
The film's done.
The film's done.
The film's done. It's out. It's won some awards already.
Wait a second. It's out?
It's out.
Why haven't I seen this?
I've invited you to screenings, Tony. I don't know. Why
I'm
haven't
very
you come?
Deep down. Where can people see this movie?
They should go to atyourcervixmovie.com.
Okay.
And join our community. We will let them know as it's screening. Yeah, no, it's on the road right now. We're doing film festivals. We're screening it at colleges and universities. We're doing this fall. We've got a whole tour coming up. We're also doing our own virtual release. So if you go on the website, there will be a, you know, please notify me when that happens.
Okay.
And then we will let people know. It's going to be, don't tell anyone. It's going to be on PBS in the future.
Wait a second.
I know.
But I thought we defunded PBS. Oh, that's NPR. We didn't defund either.
Yeah.
Well, this is exactly what should be on PBS.
I think so.
Well, hold on, though. Is there nudity in this? There's got to be, right?
Not really. We
It's tasteful.
It's tasteful.
And, I mean, kids aren't going to watch this anyways.
I don't know.
Men probably aren't even.
The men who watch it are like, wow, I had no idea.
Oh, really?
They learn a lot.
Do you still have that great image for the poster? Where it was like kind of dark around the edges and these eyes are looking through this.
They're looking in the speculum. Yeah.
That's the poster?
Yeah.
That's an awesome image.
Yeah. 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 We want people to see the film. It's not, you know, it's a hard film for folks, you know, mm-hmm. because we're tapping into medical trauma. Many people have had medical trauma, whether it was this or something else, I think, mm-hmm. you know, but there's really no more vulnerable place for any human than to put their life in someone else's hands and say, you will put me under anesthesia, not so far that I go, but that, you know, and then you're going to take care of my body. I'm entrusting my body to you while I am under anesthesia. I mean, there's really no greater trust than that. So I think the breach of trust with this is so immense. People don't want to believe that it happens, but literally, research came out last year that showed that 84% of students have done at least one exam on an anesthetized patient.
Wow.
How
has the medical community responded to your movie?
Well, it's not a monolith. So far, I can say nurses get it the fastest. They are very interested in it, as are medical students. And we really want to reach medical students because we feel that's the only way this is going to change. I mean, this has literally been going on since the dawn of gynecology. You know how gynecology started?
No.
Yeah?
No.
No?
No.
Well, we have a whole historical piece in the film because it's important for people to understand that gynecology as a discipline was established by a man named Marion Sims, who's been often called the father of gynecology. And he made his name in gynecology by experimenting violently on not anesthetized patients. Mm. They were awake and feeling everything, and they were black enslaved women.
Oh.
And that's how, you know, he did repeated experimental surgeries to try to perfect different practices and, you know, met with some success with that and was very much lauded for that work. And he did that very much at the pain and expense of a lot of black women. And so I think that history, if we really look at that as being the genesis of gynecology, it's not a big stretch to think, oh, well, no wonder they think it's okay if patients are under anesthesia to just do what they need to do because they're there and, you know, there's this body that's available to them.
Hmm.
And there's this idea of like, oh, well, you know, people know what happens in a teaching hospital. No, they don't. Nobody thinks that because they're going into a teaching hospital that they're going to get extra pelvic exams that they don't need for their own care that are solely for the education of some students. Now, that doesn't mean they might not be willing, but they want to be asked.
Is it clearly marked that you're in a teaching hospital? So like
some of them are. Some of them are. It's not clear. Yeah, there might be doctors there that work with universities, but maybe they're not in a university facility in their practice, and they're working with students. I mean, students can be in a lot of different kinds of
because UCLA has
spaces,
has places.
Sure,
USC Reagan.
Yep.
I'm sorry, UCLA Reagan. Yeah. USC King. Yeah. King Drew. Should I assume that just because it has college letters on there that maybe it's a teaching hospital as opposed to Kaiser or Cedars?
Yeah, it's probably more likely you're going to see students there. But like I said, students are sometimes in small clinics. They're not always in hospitals. I mean, this can happen in all kinds of different facilities. And it's important to say it doesn't happen in all of them.
Right.
You know, not all doctors are teaching their students this way. But I do think there's a paternalism in medicine and medical education where a lot of the doctors in practice that are working with students say, well, this is how I learned, and so they're going to learn that way. I mean, it's the same thing people use with circumcision of boys. Well, I'm circumcised and I want my son to look like me. This doesn't make any sense when you're literally choosing to keep reproducing and extending something that a practice that actually is violent. It's a violation of people.
And again, the ultimate purpose of making this examination more human, more scientific, and I don't want to say more pleasant, but less unpleasant, is so that women do this regularly so that they can catch things early, right? Is that the purpose?
Yeah. I mean, as far as gynecological care, yeah. I mean, and the recommendations keep changing. I mean, we don't need annual exams anymore. We need them every 3 years now. Even 5 years, depending on what our last number of Paps were. So, you know, those things keep changing. And so, you know, I also think this idea that everyone who goes through medical school has to do, you know, I don't know, they all have quotas. They've got some quota when they're on their rotations that says, oh, you've got to do 30 exams or whatever.
They do?
Yeah. And so I think that's why there's this pressure of like, get in there and get as much experience as you can. And, you know, and so the system is problematic in some really critical ways. There's someone that we interview in the film who did some writing about this. When he was in medical school, he did over 100 exams on his 3-week rotation on patients. 100 different patients. That's just one student.
Right.
At one medical school. This wasn't 80 years ago. This was like 10 years ago. You know, and he ended up feeling so horrible. There was such a deep moral injury to him that he went to the law school, solicited their help, and they went and got a law passed in the state of Hawaii banning this practice.
Good.
So he went on to do something good with it. But, you know, I think, like, understanding, like, that's one student out of 60 students. So all 60 of those students were on this rotation, you know, being told, get all this, you know, get in there, do your bimanual exam, try a speculum exam. You know, and he went on to become a psychiatrist. There was no reason for that. There was no reason for him to be invading people's bodies. At the behest of his supervisors, his precursors, preceptors. So, I mean, I think that some things like that just really need to be looked at in medical education. I mean, is it important to learn how to do a good pelvic exam? Yes, if you're going to work with people with vaginas and potentially be needing to examine that part of the body.
Yeah. This may be the dumbest question you'll hear all day. You are very aware of the trans community. Do trans people get pelvic exams?
Sure, yeah, of course.
Is it the same as with a woman who's born a woman?
Well, when you say trans people, I don't assume
there
you mean
go.
One particular thing.
I hope you know what I'm asking.
Well, trans men who have vaginas would need a pelvic exam.
Okay.
They still have a vagina. If they have a cervix, then they're going to want to do a pap smear and check the cervix. If there's trans women who have had vaginas created surgically, they're still going to want to maintain their own health. You know, they're still going to go in for an exam. It's not, they're not going to get a pap smear.
Right.
Because there's not a cervix or a place where they're going to be taking those cells from in the same way. But sure. We all need to know that that part of our body's healthy.
Do you think that medical students are being trained on trans people?
I mean, I think that in general, we know that with violations in medicine or in any system, it is always the most marginalized people that are harmed the most. And the same thing goes for this. I mean, I think that it's very possible that it happens quite a bit with trans folks in a way that we don't necessarily know or are able to quantify. There was a Hastings report that came out about a year ago that showed that Black folks were four times as likely to have intimate exams, whether it was a pelvic or a rectal or prostate exam, intimate exams than white folks. So,
wow.
I mean, we know that. We know that there's so many racial disparities in healthcare, and mm-hmm. this is another one.
Can people download this movie? Because it might be uncomfortable for some people to watch it in a public spot.
If they join us for our virtual screening, they'll be able to watch it in their own
good
private, private company, whatever that is
for
them.
And I like the way you phrase it. I think every person with a vagina for sure should watch this movie, right? Because they're going to have to go through this.
I mean, I think we should all care about this.
Men,
you know,
watch
I mean,
it too.
literally. Patients are being violated while they're under anesthesia. You know, this is a social justice documentary. We are working on laws right now in 7 different states. We just wrote a law from scratch in Colorado. It just passed both houses almost unanimously, and it's getting ready to be signed by the governor. I'm very proud of that.
When you say we, who are you talking about?
My team, my legislative team of 2, which is me and one other person.
Who's the other person?
Livia Fry.
Shout out Livia Fry.
Yep.
So you... The person in front of me, imagine, the person who I saw Guns N' Roses with. I don't know, did we ever see?
We definitely saw Guns N' Roses.
Did
we? We saw so many things
We
definitely
saw Jane's Addiction. Wrote a law.
I was at the Guns N' Roses show.
Co-wrote a law.
Yes.
That got passed.
Yeah. Yeah.
Does that make you feel on top of the world?
I'm feeling great about it. What I want to see, it's the most comprehensive law in the United States yet. There are 21 states who have laws so far. We're about to sign on a few more from this session. But I mean, Missouri just passed a law. How did that happen? You know, they're burning down libraries there. So
are these laws to say you can't do it to anesthetized people who don't know?
Yes.
It's that basic.
Exactly.
And I think that that's probably why it got passed. Because even if you are the most hardcore conservative woman, you're like, yeah, no.
There's so few nonpartisan issues these days. This truly is as nonpartisan as you get, because and it doesn't matter like what side of the political aisle, so to speak, you're on. You can understand that kind of breach of someone's bodily autonomy matters.
The most private of areas.
Yeah.
They call them private parts.
Right. Yes.
And you're drugging somebody so that you can go get in there.
Well, they're not drugging them to do that, but they're being opportunistic about the fact that they're being drugged for something else.
Oh, now I've connected the dots.
Yeah. So you go in for surgery. They put you under. A lot of times they'll bring students into the room. There may be students that are part of the care team that are going to hold a retractor or whatever, get to observe or maybe help a little bit in surgery. But that's a very different thing from like, oh, go ahead and do a pelvic exam on this vagina because it's available.
Is this something that could also be passed federally? Or do you have to go to the states for this kind of thing?
There are some people that think that this is already covered over, like, the National Women's Law Center. We had a conversation with them recently. And they were talking about how they feel that it is covered under the ACA and the gender rules for non-discrimination in the ACA.
Mm-hmm.
But that hasn't stopped these institutions from doing this.
Right.
So we are not going to stop until we get laws in all 50 states. We want to see this Colorado law be the model law because it's truly the most comprehensive. It's the only law that includes whistleblower protection. It includes a very clear consent process, what that process needs to be, that this is a discrete consent process that needs to be separated from the rest of the consent
mm-hmm.
that you will give when you're going in for a procedure like that.
You have to specifically sign off on it.
Yes.
Great.
So that means they really know that this is this different thing. Are you willing to do this for students and for how many? And did you want to meet them first? And here are their names.
Mm.
Like, there's no reason why a patient shouldn't know those things.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other thing that's in this law is very clear liability. And if there is not liability, if these physicians' licenses are not on the line, and if the accreditation of the facilities is not on the line, it's not going to stop because it's been going on since the beginning.
Mm-hmm. At your cervix film?
At your cervix movie.
At your cervix movie.com.
Yes. And we are at your cervix movie on TikTok and at your cervix doc on Twitter. And you can easily find us on Facebook.
Are you doing the TikToks yourself?
Starting to. Yes.
Do you like TikTok?
It's a different beast.
It is.
I do like it because anything to not, you know, give more attention or money to Mark Zuckerberg and his crew. But yeah, I mean, the algorithm's really different. We had something go really viral really fast. We were like, oh, whoa, wowza. So we've had to, yeah, it's a learning curve.
All right, let's wrap up back in L.A. When you're in New Mexico or traveling the world, you globetrotter you, and you think about L.A. and you miss L.A., what do you miss?
The beach.
That's right. You wanted to go to the beach today.
I am going to the beach
today. Okay, good for you.
When we're finished.
And by taking you to the train station so you can go
even
to the beach?
Even if it's cold. No, I got to ride.
You got to ride? All right, good. What do you like so much about the beach? Oh, that's right. You're a mermaid, aren't you?
I am. I'm a beached mermaid in New Mexico. I've got to get out of there.
I say this because when you were living in New York, you would go to the mermaid parade all the time.
I know.
You'd doll yourself up.
Yep. It's so fun.
What is it about? Because you grew up in Riverside. You grew up in Riverside.
I did.
But then you went to school in Santa Barbara.
I did.
I don't remember you on the beach a lot in Santa Barbara.
I loved the beach. I've always loved the beach.
Were you in the water, though?
Sometimes. The water there was, you know, as you know, full of a lot of tar.
Yeah.
You'd come out with tar all over you. Well, definitely on your feet.
I only went to the beach a few times.
Oh, man.
Yeah. Stacy Tees wanted to go skinny dipping with me one very cold December.
Silly man. You didn't go?
Hell yeah, I said yes to that.
I was going to say.
I
remember Stacy Tees.
But it shouldn't take a beautiful woman to say, let's go skinny dipping in the middle of the night for me to go to the beach. We're surrounded by this beautiful beach.
You take this gorgeous beach for granted. What are you doing?
I did.
I mean, I remember one time a bunch of our friends in college, we all realized we weren't going to watch the sunset very often. And we were like, how do we have access to the most beautiful performance of the day right here off of the beautiful Central California coast, and how often do we go experience it? And so we were like, we're gonna do it every night, we're gonna meet on the beach for sunset every night and then do whatever else we're doing. And then, of course, that lasted for like 3 days or something.
Okay, so when you go to the beach today, what are you gonna do?
I am going to sit and bake in the sun, and I might have to lay all the way down because it might be a little breezy because it's not super hot yet. And then when I'm hot enough, I'm going to run in the water and dunk all the way in.
Do you wear a bikini? Do you wear a one piece?
Tone, I've never been a bikini person. Shorts.
I just ask questions here.
I know you do.
I honestly don't ever remember you at the beach. So I don't know.
Well, because you didn't go to the beach. So we weren't going to the beach together.
The runaways wore bikinis. Except I don't think Joan Jett did.
Yeah.
And you're way more of a Joan Jett person, aren't you?
Probably.
Yeah. Have you met Joan Jett?
You know, she showed up to when I was a drag king in the late 90s.
A drag king?
Yeah.
What's that?
For reals?
I am from
For reals?
The suburbs of Illinois. I know.
Dude,
I've lived here a long time.
How long have you been living under your rock?
almost the entire time.
Okay, so drag kinging became a real thing. I would say the drag king movement really took off in New York in the 90s when I had moved there. I didn't start it, but I was a part of that time. I was a part of that scene.
And these are women
who
identify as drag kings?
Yeah, who dress, you know, we're doing like Marlene Dietrich. We're like, you know. We're dressing just like drag queens.
So Madonna
Same
Vogue
thing.
Video costumes.
We are performing gender. For entertainment. That's what drag really is. To me, it's all drag. Everyone needs to get over themselves because it's all drag. Some people wear corporate drag every day. Some people wear waitress drag. Some people wear their punk rock drag. Some people wear drag. Gender drag.
It's
all drag.
Our creative studies icon, Robin Bell, wore Emily Dickinson drag.
She did. She wore Emily Dickinson drag. Exactly.
Okay, so drag king.
Yeah.
Is what? It's, are you cross-dressing?
It's performing masculinity as drag.
Women performing masculinity.
Sure.
And do you do the dances? So I know what a drag queen does. Is it similar for a drag king?
There's definitely, you know, more lip syncing involved than, you know, any of us would like. But
that's the
fun
thing.
It could be fun. It could be fun.
None of us are going to sing better than Beyonce. So we may as well lip sync, right?
Well, we'd be like singing, you know, Billy Idol, or we'd be singing like Elvis or something.
That makes sense.
Right.
What do you remember what you would sing as a drag king?
Oh, I did a lot of Prince. I did a lot of Prince.
Yeah.
I was like kind of a ladies man, so I usually had like a really sexy woman on both arms. And so, yeah, one night I was hosting, I started a show called Cocktail, and I was hosting the show, and Joan Jett kind of sneaks in a few minutes late and sits down in the front for the whole show, and she snuck out before I got to talk to her at the end. But yeah, so Joan Jett one time saw me perform drag in New York. I'm sure she remembers.
Okay, I'm going to ask you a question you don't have to answer if you don't want to. You have been with men. You've been with women. You've been with trans people. Intimately. In bed. Maybe not even on bed. Maybe on a chair. Maybe on the floor. Maybe on the ceiling.
All the places.
What is different about being with a trans person?
You can't make a generalization like that.
Please do, though. Trans people make up what? 1% of the society?
Those numbers are coming up.
Because, do you think it's 2%?
I mean, I don't think we necessarily know.
Because they're in the closet still?
Yeah, and because our ideas about gender are evolving. And I think that... Mm-hmm. More and more people are understanding that gender isn't a binary. It's not like A or B, that it's a spectrum. It's, there's a lot of different kinds of people. Just like there's diversity in all other aspects of who we are. Why would we think then that with gender, it's just so special that it's not as diverse? Like, we've got all these ethnic differences and religious differences and body size and type differences and color and all the things, but like, oh, but gender, it's one or two. You know, it makes no sense.
You're right, it doesn't.
You know, look at this garden we're sitting in. I mean, how many kinds of flowers are we looking at, and how many colors right in this moment?
And you mentioned a perfect person with Prince. So here's a guy, mm-hmm, who dresses as if he was gay, or at least bi, but we've never heard a story about Prince being gay or bi.
He had a...
What?
He had a woman alter ego.
Right.
He had that.
Yes.
But we weren't calling it transgender then. We were, you know, we didn't have that language. And he didn't use that language because he wasn't interested in fitting in people's boxes anyway.
Exactly. But so, what I'm saying is, a man growing up in the Midwest like I did, if Prince wasn't a rock star and he just walked down the street with his lingerie and his frilliness, we'd be like, oh, yeah, look at the gay guy over there. But he wasn't.
No, he really did love women. He really,
right,
really loved women.
Right.
But he also loved the woman in himself.
But my point is, to your point, there is a huge spectrum of people.
Right.
And you can dress that way and have no interest in making out with a dude.
Well, how you express your gender doesn't denote who you are as a sexual person. They're two, mm-hmm, different things, but we conflate those all the time.
So, my original question on what's different about being with a trans person, is the correct answer everybody's different no matter what their, whatever their thing is? That kissing one girl is just as different as kissing another girl is just as different as kissing a boy or a trans person?
I think what's different is that we're conditioned differently. Women are, cis women are conditioned in a very particular way from a very young age. It's our job to be pretty and sexually attractive. That's our job. And so we may follow that and internalize that, or we may push up against that and,
right,
and learn how to be something that feels more authentic to who we really are. And it might also be that. That's fine, too.
Yeah.
There's nothing wrong with that if that's really truly who we want to be. Men are socialized in a particular way as well. Mm. I think the thing, and why I wrote my first book, lesbian sex secrets for men was that there's a lot of things for heterosexuals to learn from queer sex. There's a lot of things for heterosexuals to be freed up around the ways in which queer people have sex. That's one place where I think we've won a little bit, because we don't have quite as much of the preconditioning as heterosexuals do. You know, in sex, boy is going to play this role, girl's going to play that role. We don't have that as much. It does exist in queer and gay communities, but there's a lot more terrain that we get to explore. It's not assumed one particular person's going to play one particular role all the time or whatever. And so I think it gives us more opportunity to explore and be authentic in that exploration and find out the things that we like. And I think that that's something that a lot of heterosexual people are envious of. I think they, for sure, they see that. And I actually think that that is part of why all of these oppressive laws are happening. It's like, that's too radical. That is too free. We cannot have these queer folk, whoever they are, trans folk, LGBTQ, whatever, alphabet people, being that free. That's very threatening to the status quo. That's very threatening to our power structures. We don't want that. And that's why we're seeing that.
Let me ask you about a lesbian bar recently opened up in Silver Lake. And they say it's one of the first lesbian bars in a really, really long time. New bar. Why? How come lesbians don't even want to drink with each other?
Women don't drink as much.
It's just hard in general.
It's hard for the bars to stay open. They don't make enough money.
If it's lesbian only.
Yeah. Men drink way more. They spend way more money on alcohol.
So when...
And they have more disposable income to spend on it. That's real,
than
too.
Lesbian women?
Yeah.
Oh, because men still make more money.
Yeah. So we're still part of that.
So this brunch thing that women have on Saturdays and Sundays with the bottomless mimosas, that's still not, you can't make a business around that. You have to have other stuff. So a lesbian bar just isn't going to work because you guys don't drink.
They just tend to be shorter lived, but we've seen a lot of them shutting down across the U.S. over the years. Yeah. I mean, there used to be a couple really great ones in New York, you know, but they had lifespans and they got to a point where it wasn't sustainable. Lesbians love to dance. We had some good dance parties. Joan Jett used to show up at those dance parties. She would often be cited.
So that's why it has to be a pop-up. So maybe then could they piggyback on a gay bar then and say like Fridays or lesbians nights,
yeah,
or something?
Sometimes that kind of stuff happens. If the owners want to share.
Right.
But yeah, it's just it's hard to keep to have a lesbian bar that's like 7 days a week. That's hard to do. There's a couple in New York that've been there for really, really decades and decades. They're kind of institutions there, but
it's also,
also
a giant city. Yeah. So you've a lot of people to choose from.
Yeah, and people will seek it out when they come into town. But yeah, it's not easy.
All right, let's wrap up with you hinted to the fact that your first book, Lesbian Sex Secrets for Men, has advice for straight men. Can you give us one bit of advice from that book?
Well, we came back in 2015 and did the second edition when I was doing my second book, because they were both with Penguin Random House. And so they said, well, oh my God, it sold a lot. Let's update it. And so we went back, you know, when we originally wrote the book, we sent out a little... Email was new then, you know, we sent out a little questionnaire by email and got people's responses. So we were like, well, this will be way easier on the socials now to check in with people and figure out, like, what is it that women are wanting men to know? What have they not figured out? Let's see if it's any different. It was not one bit different. It was exactly the same answers that it was 15 years before. Go ahead.
Men don't go down on women. And
yes,
when they do,
definitely complain.
They don't
about
do
that.
It as long as the women want them to.
Yep.
They don't know what they're doing down there. They need to learn. And in the sex part, the sex part, men don't wait for the women to complete.
Yeah. I mean, I would say the overall response, the overall biggest response was slow down and be more gentle.
Oh.
Just slow the fuck down.
Okay.
Now, some of us maybe don't always want it gentle or slow. So that's true too. But by and large, we hear all the time from women, they're going for my genitals too fast. They you know, maybe just like even the kind of thrusting, the kind of sex they want to have is too fast, too hard, too much. Slow down. Slow down.
Interesting. Okay. I have another question for you, though. As you know, I've been very popular with the ladies my whole life. I have had a few very, I think, very lucky encounters with a few women mm-hmm. where just magic happened. Because mm-hmm. Lord knows I don't know what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. The Lord does know that. And so it was earth-shattering to me to just fit with somebody. But also, it was more of a dance. It was more of a dance that we just innately knew. Mm-hmm. And we didn't have to talk. We didn't have to ask. We didn't even do a recap afterwards, you know, smoking cigarettes, looking at the ceiling. Other than, what the fuck was that? And then when we do it again, it was the same. And then again, it was the same. And we didn't get along necessarily in life like that. But when it came to that act, it was absolutely perfect every single time. Is that an anomaly, or is that a goal that people should shoot for and they could achieve?
I don't think that needs to be a goal. I think it's great if that happens, where you just feel like we're like defying this universe, you know, we don't even have to like communicate in 3D time.
Well, there was a little communication. She did say, don't call me that.
So. Yeah. I mean, I think it's this, that's like the part of that romantic myth is the problem. That we think, well, if we were really made for each other, I wouldn't have to tell you at all. You would just know.
True, true.
And that's bullshit.
Yeah.
Nobody knows.
Right.
I don't even know what my partner wants on the different day sometimes.
Oh.
So, you know, this idea that if we're just really tuned in to each other, we should know is ridiculous. Now, can we learn to tune in and read body signs better and understand what it means when she pulls back like that, or when she arches her back like that, or, you know, whatever. Yes, we can learn those things. Mm-hmm. But I think we've got to get away from this idea that we should just know, or that somehow that knowing is going to indicate the level of compatibility or receptivity we might have for this particular person. That's just mm-hmm. not always true. Mm-hmm. And for me, like, talking about it's really hot. I love that part. That's foreplay. That's mid play.
Yeah.
You know, getting to relive it and talk about, oh, babe, oh my gosh. We had really good sex last night. Let's talk about that.
Right.
Oh, yeah. What was your favorite part? Oh, my God. Tell me about that. Oh, my God. Right? That's fun. Then we get to relive it again tomorrow. Mm-hmm. You know, like, or 2 years from
now. This connection that I'm talking about, where it just clicks.
Yeah. Sometimes it does.
Because I imagine some of it's chemistry.
Yep.
Mick Jagger and Keith Richards have chemistry together.
Sure.
You know? And
50 years. That's
you
a
just,
long time.
And you just can't pluck somebody else next to Keith Richards and you have the same thing, right? Magic happens sometimes between
sure.
people.
Absolutely.
If you're not having good sex with your partner
yeah.
repeatedly for years, can that be fixed all the time?
No. Sometimes it can.
Sometimes it's just not.
Sometimes it can, and people just really haven't gone the way to, you know, hey, let's like invest in this. Let's figure out what would make this better. Mm-hmm. Let's work with someone professional. Let's go to some workshops together. Let's
right.
read a sexy book together. I mean, there's so many ways to bring new sexual energy into a long-term relationship that people often just don't do.
And I'm not talking Edith Bunker and Archie Bunker. I'm talking two evolved people mm-hmm. who are sexy people mm-hmm. who are in tune and can communicate. Sometimes it just doesn't work, right?
Sometimes it doesn't.
The magic just doesn't happen. It's just
they
bodies.
Love each other as friends. They're wonderful companions, but there's no juice.
Right.
And then also, I just think we've been sold a lie about what our closest intimate relationships are supposed to look like. You know, we've been told that the same person that you do the bills with. You wash their dirty laundry and underwear. You negotiate picking up the kids and driving them all over town with. You share a house with, and you like never really get a break from, especially pandemic, now that everyone's working from home. And like that you're supposed to have sex, sexy, romantic, delicious, sweet, hot times with that same person. Like we've been sold a real bundle here.
Yeah.
That's like, it's not easy for anyone to do that well. I don't live with my partner, and, you know, and we've talked about, we don't know if we will ever live together because
really?
We really think not living together is a lot of what keeps it hot.
Oh.
We're like really excited to see each other every time we see each other when we, you know,
yeah,
we have a couple dates a week and we get a lot of time to ourselves, and they have a child and they're busy with the child. And
so if two sexy people mm-hmm. who love each other aren't having great sex,
move out.
Move out. Don't beat yourself up.
I'm just kidding.
Because it just that might not, not, it's just not be a connection.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's so many things that can be getting in the way. And then also when there's other untended things in a relationship, that's going to show up in the sexual relationship.
And, but if you truly are committed and you're like, fine, well, let's work this out.
Yeah.
Let's make this backyard beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
Do some shrooms, maybe. Do a little ecstasy. Test your ecstasy first. Could be fentanyl in there.
Do a ritual with it.
A ritual?
I did that with my partner recently.
What's that?
Like a ritual where
you
come in with a lot of intention and you're like decide, you know, we made a list of questions we wanted to ask each other. And we went down those questions and
questions
gave each other
like
deep, rich questions about one another. You know, to learn more about each other and also about what we thought of the relationship, where we were at in the relationship.
Oh, you got real deep.
Yeah, we got really deep.
Real vulnerable.
We gave each other some real honest feedback.
Questions that if you might not get the answer you want.
Yeah. Some of it was really hard.
Mm-hmm.
But the MDMA helps you be really receptive. You know, that's why so much therapy is now being done with psychedelics.
Yeah.
Because it opens us up in a different way. It lowers our defenses. It, you know, if we're in the right headspace, it can really allow for tremendous vulnerability and intimacy and connection.
Ecstasy is more like butterflies and sweetness. And let me touch your skin. Let me see what your hair feels like up against my cheek. And that, I love that stuff. I love that stuff more than...
I think a lot of people are actually really missing that.
But right.
I think for men, the cis men, right? The...
Mm-hmm.
The space of intimacy that you've been given permission for is very narrow.
True.
And so when you want intimacy, you might actually mean something else, but the only thing you know how to ask for or you know to really go for or want is sex, whatever sex is to you.
Right. Imagine.
And some days maybe it is sex, but.
Imagine you're the best. I'm so grateful that we've had our friendship for so long. You continue to educate me. I am so thrilled that you're educating the rest of the planet, too, that I get to share your intelligence and your insight and your study and your courage, because it is courageous to tell the medical professional that they're doing it wrong.
We'll see what happens. We'll see. We'll see if the medical schools invite us. I hope they do.
PBS,
I hope they do.
Good for you for embracing this. Because that's also very courageous on their part.
Yeah, thank you.
Because they don't do a lot of punk rock things like this.
Yeah, we'll see how it goes.
I love you. Thank you for being here.
I love you too, Tone.
Yay! How great was Imagine? You know whose lost phones we'd help find? Our Patreons. When you stoke us, you're saying, Tony, Jordan, thanks for letting us hear from a sexpert. Take our money. So shout out to our Patreons, Nancy Rommelman, Sean Atlow, Matt Mills, Sean Wallace, Greg and Molly, Jamie Taylor, Mark Johnson, Kira Ann, Barney Grinke, Ben Welsh, Jen Adams, Trevor Wilson, Bree Wild, Dougie Gyro, Christina Up North, Robin Carey, Adam Shorn, Ben from Down Under, Chris from the ATX, and Gregor. To be a Patreon, all you gotta do is go to patreon.com/hereinLA. And just give it all, baby.
Also, shout out to our Angelinos. To be an Angelino, all you got to do is PayPal or Venmo, $25 or more, and we will list you on the Here in LA website or Medium blog forever. Special shout out to our newest Angelino, Sean Atlow. Merci! Just send your hard-earned cash to busblog@gmail.com. Want to support us, but you just spent a bunch of cash on an adults-only summer camp? You can still help. Post your favorite episode on your Facebook, OMG Post 2. Tweet something nice about this. In fact, anytime you see me tweet about an episode, retweet it. And for God's sakes, tell your friends. Tell them how Here in LA is spelled, and it's on Apple Podcasts and Google and Amazon and Spotify and blah, 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 blah. Here in LA is produced by myself, Tony Pierce, and a man who would never operate on you without your consent, Jordan Katz. Editing, mixing, and music supervision by Jordan Katz. Songs by Orgone and Jordan Katz. Special thanks to Cindy for creating the logo, Jen for inspiring this, and people everywhere doing their best to make the world a better place. Thank you, Patriots!